The fact that my position wasn't filled and other programs were not being enacted made it clear that the administration was dropping the ball.
A former Interior employee agrees with a federal report showing problems with the department's handling of job reassignments. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Army Corps responds to criticism of its environmental review for the Pebble Mine.
We had already decided from our learning experience on these other large mine projects that we were going to build as many efficiencies into the process as we could.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A new federal report sheds some light on how job reassignments in the Department of Interior were handled last year. Joel Clement resigned from the agency in October after being ousted from his position working on issues like coastal resilience and village relocation in Alaska. He felt targeted by the Trump administration for his views on climate change, and he thinks this report helps back that up. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
There wasn't much of a paper trail to show Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's motivation for reassigning dozens of career officials last summer. An internal investigation found that the board responsible for those reassignments didn't maintain meeting minutes, notes, voting, or decision records. There wasn't a person responsible for documenting it.
It's a very damning report, and it demonstrates the kind of the chaos and incompetence at play.
Clement was assigned to accounting duties at the Office of Oil and Gas Royalties, which he says was much different than the job he had before, coordinating federal efforts to help move eroding villages in Alaska. He believes the Trump administration is trying to erase positions that have anything to do with climate change. And the report from the Office of Inspector General, he says, points to that lack of transparency.
What it doesn't do is look back and say, okay, well, how would they make this right with these executives who were either discriminated against or retaliated against?
The Deputy Director of Interior responded to the report, saying confirming key presidential appointments could be responsible for guidelines not being followed. The report outlines recommendations, like keeping records on plans for reassigning senior executives. As for Clement's old position, that still hasn't been filled. He acknowledges village relocation efforts are still underway. The Denali Commission is set to receive $15 million to help move Newtalk.
I think the fact that my position wasn't filled and other programs were not being enacted made it clear that the administration was dropping the ball. And so Congress knew that they had to pick this up.
Next, he hopes Congress holds the Department of the Interior accountable. He would like to see a congressional hearing on the job reassignments. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The full Senate is scheduled to debate amendments to the state's operating budget tomorrow. The Senate Finance Committee passed the bill yesterday. The committee substituted its own version of the budget bill for the one the House passed. The Senate bill would provide $4.25 billion to fund the portion of the budget that the legislature focuses on each year. It has $1 billion for Alaska Permanent Fund dividends, which would provide a $1,600 dividend. The biggest difference from the House budget is that the Senate bill does not include more than $1 billion for school funding. The Senate would provide that money in a separate bill. Committee co-chairman Lyman Hoffman, a Bethel Democrat, says the school funding bill is intended to reduce the risk of widespread layoff notices.
Hopefully we can come to an understanding with other bodies so that early funding can happen. I'm optimistic that pink slips will not go out.
The Senate budget has less money than the House for Medicaid and would cut more than $13 million of the $19 million increase that the House budgeted for the University of Alaska. And the Senate version would cut out more for oil and gas tax credits, would pay out more for oil and gas tax credits. The Senate could vote on the budget as soon as tomorrow. Once the Senate passes it, the House would have to vote on whether to accept the Senate's version. If it doesn't, the two chambers will work out the differences through a conference Conference Committee. The scheduled 90-day end of the session is Sunday, although it's not likely lawmakers will be done. Voters passed an initiative in 2006 that set the session length at 90 days in state law. But the legislature can go past that date. The state constitution sets the session limit at 121 days. A state bill that would ban smoking in workplaces took a major step forward last night. The House Rules Committee passed a new version of Senate Bill 63. Committee Chairwoman Gabrielle Ledoux, an Anchorage Republican, had declined to schedule a hearing for most of the session. She says she scheduled the hearing now to allow it to move forward to a vote on the House floor.
I've got some questions about this entire bill, in fact, but nevertheless, in order to extend an olive branch to the people who really want this bill, trying to do something to get this bill in a reasonable form so that we can get it to the floor.
The committee changed the bill so that it won't affect the use of electronic cigarettes or marijuana. It also would allow municipalities to opt out of the workplace smoking ban. Currently, municipalities can opt in to bans. Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Quito opposed the changes.
We've got more than enough support for the bill as it sits on the House floor. I do not appreciate, I guess, having these changes being added at this late date in this forum on this particular bill.
The Senate passed the bill last year. It will need to go back for another vote in the Senate if the House approves the changed version. Another environmental assessment of the proposed Pebble Mine is underway. This time, the lead agency is the Army Corps of Engineers. In a call with reporters today, the Army Corps addressed criticism it's already receiving as it weighs whether to give the controversial mine a permit. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Sheila Newman with the Army Corps says the agency recognizes that the proposed Pebble Mine is not your average project. It has a long history in Alaska, so it's trying to make adjustments for that. For example, it gave the public a longer than usual period to read the permit application before the first comment period.
We went for, you know, complete public access and transparency as soon as we possibly could for this project by making the application publicly available. I think it was 15 days after we received it. So that was a first.
The Army Corps recently extended the first public comment period, called the scoping period, by 2 months after Native corporations and top officials like Lisa Murkowski said 30 days wasn't enough. Mine opponents also charge that the Army Corps is fast-tracking its environmental review for Pebble. The agency says its final decision on Pebble could happen as soon as early 2020, which would be faster than the review for the Donlin Mine by several years. Newman says the shortened timeline is because the Army Corps has improved its review process.
We had already decided, from our learning experience on these other large mine projects, Donlin and Chewitna, that we were going to build as many efficiencies into the process as we could so we are not spending unnecessary time.
Of course, Newman can't say whether the Army Corps will grant Pebble its permit once the process is complete. She also wouldn't say what would lead the agency to deny a permit, but she acknowledged a denial is rare for the Army Corps.
So I would say that the district has denied less than 1% of the permits over the past fiscal year for sure.
But Newman says many applicants withdraw their permit applications before a decision is made if a project can't minimize environmental damage to the Army Corps standards. Currently, the Army Corps is asking for public input on what they should consider in their environmental analysis for the proposed Pebble Mine. That comment period now ends on June 29th. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a windstorm barrels through southeast, knocking out power in some areas.
There are some trees pulled down the lines in that area, caused a problem. We have to shut the highway down for a while. It was unsafe to cross.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Right now, Alaska owes nearly $900 million to companies in the form of oil tax credits. A bill that would have the state issue bonds to pay those companies is on the move in the legislature. The House Resources Committee voted Tuesday morning to pass its version of the bill, though the committee's co-chair, Anchorage Representative Garen Tarr, says she doesn't support it. She says the state would be swapping one type of interest-free debt for another that could have less favorable repayment terms. If the state issues bonds and then fails to make payments, that could affect its credit rating.
And it means that we would have to prioritize it over other important state needs like public safety if there were such a time as everything falls out from under us. So that's difficult for me.
The state's tax credit bill stems from a program that was designed to encourage companies to explore and develop new oil fields. As oil prices sank, the Walker administration pulled back and made minimum payments on what the state owes. Those oil and gas companies and some banks have repeatedly told lawmakers that the unpaid credits are hurting development in Alaska. Pat Galvin is the chief commercial officer of Great Bear Petroleum. He says the unpaid credits harmed companies' ability to get financing for exploration and development. Galvin says the company has exploration wells on the North Slope that are on hold.
The funding is held up because of the uncertainty over these tax credit payments.
A companion Senate bill has moved into the Senate Finance Committee as well. From there, the bills must move to the House and Senate floors to be voted on. School administrators, teachers, and parents from across the state testified before the House Finance Committee Tuesday in support of increased school funding. Anchorage Representative Les Guerra's House Bill 339 would increase the base student allocation by $100 to $6,030. The BSA determines how much money school districts receive on a per-student basis. Guerra, a Democrat, said he has heard repeatedly from teachers who feel the daily burden of budget cuts.
Class sizes up, the number of students they have to teach are up, and they really don't feel the support coming from the legislature at all. So we're also possibly losing our best teachers, and that's not the way to move forward.
No one spoke against the bill. A number of school district superintendents testified in favor. Many were in town for this week's Alaska Association of School Administrators legislative fly-in. The common message was clear. School districts have been hit hard by budget cuts, and they can't take any more. Without the bill, the proposed budget would flat fund K-12 education again next school year. Multiple testifiers pointed out that this amounts to a decrease since costs continue to rise for schools. Health insurance premiums are one of the biggest reasons. Many spoke about unsustainable increases to classroom size and teachers who are spread too thin by their workloads. Huna School District Superintendent Ralph Watkins is also the principal, technology director, and a middle school teacher out of necessity. He said education is too important for legislators not to act.
In Huna, we are combining classes. We have kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. Our sixth grade has moved into middle school. This is unsustainable.
The bill has another hearing scheduled today, but time is running out. Senate leaders said earlier this week they are hopeful the legislative session will wrap up close to the 90-day mark on Sunday. Ketchikan was warned Tuesday morning to expect a big storm that afternoon, and the warning was spot on. Weather observers clocked sustained winds around 70 miles per hour and gusts exceeding 100. The storm knocked down trees and power lines throughout the community, keeping repair crews busy through this morning. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
A fast-moving storm whipped through southeast on Tuesday, with the biggest winds hitting Alaska's first city. Sharon Sullivan is a meteorologist intern with the National Weather Service in Juneau. She said mid-morning Wednesday that the storm force low developed rapidly in the morning near Haida Gwaii in British Columbia, south of Ketchikan.
So it developed yesterday morning and affected a lot of the southern panhandle and then reached kind of the central Gulf by late last night, and it's already on its exit in the northern Gulf right now.
According to the National Weather Service, the highest recorded gusts were in Ketchikan, but everyone in southeast experienced a strong storm.
So at Salmon Landing in Ketchikan, gusts up to 112 miles per hour recorded. We also have Lincoln Island at 74, Ketchikan Airport at 73, Annette Island at 69. Yeah, Wrangell Airport was about 45. So those are some of the ones on the higher end.
While the official National Weather Service report for Metlakatla was a high of 69 miles per hour, residents report that wind gusts were much stronger. Sullivan says Prince of Wales Island also reported high winds. The storm hit the west coast of the Big Island first, with gusts up to 77 miles per hour and sustained winds around 60. Hurricane force winds are sustained winds not including gusts of at least 74 miles per hour, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Sullivan says Wrangell reported some trees down and shingles blown off a roof. In Ketchikan, though, pretty much an entire roof blew off a home on Jackson Street, according to Andy Donato of Ketchikan Public Utilities Electric Division. That led to one of many wind-related power outages. An event affecting the most people was in the Mountain Point area and brought traffic to a halt on South Tongass Highway.
There are some trees pulled down the lines in that area, caused a problem. We have to shut the highway down for a while. It was unsafe to cross there with the power lines being stretched and down.
Donato says some people weren't happy about the road closure, which was announced a little after 5 and kept a lot of people from getting home until after 7:30 p.m. But he says it was a serious safety concern. The tree leaning into a live power line meant the line was essentially grounded.
So if one of the higher lines, which is energized, touches that tree or a branch tickles that, it'll bring that voltage down to ground. And if you're standing in and around the area, so the other thing, people thought they could leave their cars and walk. I told them, no, I can't let you do that. You can't walk over there. And that's because you'll have something called a high ground potential. And it's dangerous.
Donato says most areas had power back by around 10 p.m. Tuesday, although a few individual homes remained without electricity through Wednesday morning. He thanked the community for understanding and supporting KPU line crews. Also out working in the storm were U.S. Coast Guard boat and helicopter crews. There had been a report of a possible overturned skiff during the windstorm. A Coast Guard spokesman reported Wednesday morning that the skiff was eventually found, safely moored, and the occupants were fine. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
A group opposing a controversial ballot initiative to strengthen salmon habitat protections raised more than $2 million since January, roughly 10 times more than initiative supporters brought in over the same period. Those figures include non-monetary contributions like air travel and staff time. In a recent filing with the Alaska Public Offices Commission, the opposition group called Stand for Alaska reported major contributions from some of Alaska's biggest industry players. Oil company BP gave over $500,000 and ConocoPhillips gave $250,000. Other big donors to Stand for Alaska included mining companies like Pebble Limited Partnership and Donlin Gold. Yes for Salmon, the group backing the ballot initiative, reported contributions of just over $200,000. Its largest contribution was $100,000 from John Childs, who is chairman of a Massachusetts private equity firm. Childs is also on the board of the Wild Salmon Center, an environmental group supporting the ballot initiative. Yes for Salmon supporters say the state's current permitting rules for projects that could affect salmon habitat are too lax, while the industry argues the measure would effectively shut down a wide range of projects. But it's not yet guaranteed that voters will weigh in on the initiative. The state is opposing it in court, and the Alaska Supreme Court will hear arguments in the case later this month. Governor Bill Walker's Climate Action Leadership Team is meeting in Fairbanks today and tomorrow. The 20-member team appointed in December is charged with climate change mitigation, adaptation, research, and response. Team member, former North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins, says the group is making use of work done by a similar Palin administration panel. Hopkins, who also served on that task force, emphasizes that there are pressing issues like communities threatened by erosion.
new talk, we have probably about three more years or four more years before homes and part of the school could be in the river.
Hopkins says the climate team is also working on ways to reduce Alaska's contribution of greenhouse gases. He says that means replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy sources and warns the transition isn't happening fast enough to reach a state-set goal.
We heard from the Alaska Energy Authority that at the current rate we're moving into renewables, 1% a year, to get to 50% by 2025, we have 100 years to go. That's not acceptable, and I think the team knows that.
Hopkins says the Climate Action Team held a listening session this afternoon to hear input from the public. The team meets Thursday at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to work on an action plan due to the governor by September.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Three Alaska newspapers have changed hands again. The Peninsula Clarion, Juneau Empire, and Weekly Homer News are being acquired by a Canadian chain just 6 months after being sold to Gatehouse Media. The Alaska papers were sold by longtime owner Morris Communications for $120 million last fall. The newest owner is Seattle-based Sound Publishing that owns papers in the states of Washington, California, and Hawaii. It's a subsidiary of Black Press, based in British Columbia. In recent months, the trio of Alaska papers shared a top executive, but he's staying with Gatehouse. Outgoing publisher Joe Leong says today he'll be leaving Alaska at the end of the month, but he said he's optimistic about the three papers' future.
I think just like Gatehouse, Sound Publication is committed to reporting news for the community and being involved in the community.
His replacement hasn't been announced, nor have the new owners made any specific commitments over staffing or other resources, but Leong says there isn't much fat to trim.
You know, we all run lean operations as it is, but they need to review the operation and take a look for themselves.
Terms of the deal weren't disclosed, but in a related development, the Akron Beacon Journal also announced today that Black Press was selling the Ohio Daily to Gatehouse Media for a reported $16 million. A news release said the deal helps the two chains cluster their holdings more closely. Black Press has newspapers in the Pacific Northwest. Gatehouse Media owns other small papers in Ohio. Black Press made media news in 2010 when it closed a pair of newspapers in BC 2 weeks after buying them. Over the years, it's also shuttered a newspaper in Washington and merged two daily newspapers in Honolulu with the Honolulu Star Advertiser, its largest holding. The company is unconnected to the late Canadian media mogul Conrad Black. Yet another Alaska reality TV show debuts this week, but unlike dozens of previous shows featuring inept gold miners, snow machine chases of drunken criminals, or former governors, the latest show promises to put the real back into reality TV. It could even be educational. KTOO's Matt Miller has a preview of the new show featuring faces familiar to Juneau viewers.
The new program, Alaska Treasure Hunters, features four Juneau men as they explore and search for long-forgotten historic sites. The program has been well over a year in development and production. It was inspired by the very popular Juneau Hidden History Facebook page that Joe McCabe and Brian Weed started 5 years ago.
So to bring it to TV and actually show these things, it's kind of Alaska's treasures. It's a part of Alaska's history that a lot of people don't realize is still there.
Weed says he rejected previous offers for a reality show because potential producers wanted to focus on the usual reality TV nonsense. Here, Weed recalls previous show pitches.
We want to make sure there's a lot of drama in your group to show that this is something people want to watch, you know. And then we'd get the questions like, do you believe in ghosts? Have you seen aliens? Just off-the-wall questions, and a couple times I hung up on them where I was like, I want nothing to do with this kind of show because there's plenty of those shows that make Alaska look bad.
Weed, who serves as the historian for the group, says it's not really a reality show. Instead, he calls it a docu-follow. The places and historic events are real. The dialogue is not scripted ahead of time, and there's no manufactured drama among the cast. Joe McCabe is the group's safety officer.
I'm a retired rock climber, retired Juneau Mountain Rescue guy, so I bring some mountaineering experience, a lot of rock experience and rescue stuff.
Greg Taylor is the jack-of-all-trades outdoor survival expert who keeps the group headed in the right direction.
Yeah, it kept us from getting lost, even though we knew where we were going to begin with.
Okay, so you're the map guy. You're the
yeah,
one.
I am. Yeah, yeah. I keep track of the GPS and coordinates.
Adam DiPietro is a mountaineer with a background in geology and engineering.
Brian knows roughly how old the mine is based on the history of it, you know, the logs and what you can find in the archives. But I can take it and I can measure the how much rust has actually occurred, how much oxidation, and back calculate to figure out, based on the rate of rusting, how old the object is. So there's two different schools of thought to figure out how old something is.
A fifth cast member, who is unavailable for an interview, is the group's scout and bear guard, Weed's dog named Cat. The pilot episode features a search for the lost Rocker Mine, which undercuts the popular myth of Joe Juneau and Richard Harris as the first white men who discovered gold in the Juneau area in 1880. According to the group, gold was actually discovered 13 years earlier by a man named Fred Culver.
He died before he could come back and really stake a claim and actually get super rich. This is us looking for Culver's mine based on all the data, facts, journals that we can get a hold of, and we're tracing back to the location of the lost Rocker Mine.
It was nice. We did some interviews with a lot of local folks here to help us out. It was a pretty cool process.
Some epic adventures, too.
Yeah, some epic adventures.
Yeah.
Weed also says there were some items not shown in the program that they discovered from Culver's period that could not have been left by Juneau and Harris. It's only a pilot program. Whether or not it becomes a regular series depends on the ratings and social media response. And Weed says it's not just about exploring old mines in the Juneau area. If the show gets picked up as a regular series, then they plan on traveling around Alaska, exploring old military installations such as World War II internment camps and old Nike missile defense bases, ghost towns, old native village sites and petroglyphs, Southeast Alaska fox farms, shipwrecks and plane crashes, and abandoned gold dredges and trains. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Jenkins, Andrew Kitchman, Rasha McChesney, Adeline Baxter, Jacob Resnick, and Matt Miller in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
Curious about your alcohol habits or those of someone you care about? Find a free and confidential alcohol screening at recoveralaska.org or call 211 today. This Alcohol Awareness Month, Recover Alaska reminds us that together we are stronger than alcohol addiction. Recover Alaska is a trusted source for alcohol research and resources, including an index of local available treatment options. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska, proud to support Alaska Public Media.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.